Welcome to Berkeley. Welcome back to the Bay Area.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in San Francisco, born in 1935. Lived there until 1948. And when I was 13, my grandfather was mayor of the city, 1942-46. So I sometimes got to go out with the mayor in the launch to one of the Navy ships in the bay. Mm-hmm. And I can remember being piped aboard a carrier and saluting Admiral Halsey. Mm-hmm. At some point in the middle 40s.
So from an early age, you were ready to command.
I wasn't ready to command, no. And then, of course, grandfather was also mayor when the UN Charter was written in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and I was excused from school to attend some of the plenary mm-hmm. sessions mm-hmm. in the Opera House.
And where were you educated, in San Francisco, or did you go away to school?
I went to a grammar school called the Town School for Boys in Pacific Heights in San Francisco, and then I moved east when I was 13. I went to a boarding school in Connecticut, the Hotchkiss School, then Yale, and then for a year to Cambridge, England.
So how does a son of the establishment become such a political maverick, or are you a political maverick?
I don't know. I think of myself as having. I can remember the beginning of the UN. I can remember the liberal idea of Franklin Roosevelt, the Four Freedoms. I can remember when Harry Truman came to San Francisco and. June of 1945, I think it was the biggest crowd that had ever been turned out in the history of the state. Mm-hmm. And I had developed a rather old-fashioned idea of what of the government as a servant of the people rather than the people as the servant of the government. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think of myself as a radical. I'm think of myself somebody who's trying to remember what the principles on which this country was founded.
Let's stay with your career for a while. What led you to become a writer? We'll get back to this political stuff shortly.
Well, I developed an early love for reading and for words, mm-hmm. and I couldn't imagine anything more exciting to do than to try to put words on paper. And when I left Cambridge University, I had thought I might become an historian, but I didn't have the patience mm-hmm. for scholarship. So I came back from England and went into the newspaper business in San Francisco, and I thought that would be a way to learn to write. There was a tradition in the 30s of important American writers, people like Ernest Hemingway, starting as newspaper reporters, and I thought, okay, this is the way you learn to do it. And I can remember I was assigned by the San Francisco Examiner to the Oakland City Hall. My first 4 months on the paper were in the press room. The press room was in the city hall together with the courts and the mayor's office and the police station. And I can remember my first assignment was to cover a flower show in somewhere in the foothills of Oakland. And I wrote 4,000 words on that. I brought it into the bureau chief in Oakland, a man named Crowley, wore a hat, and he looked at it, he read it, and he said, "These are the most beautiful 4,000 words I've ever read." I almost wept, he said. Then he said, "But do me a favor," he said, "see if you can cut it in half." Mm-hmm. And so I did, and I brought it back, and then he said, we went through this again, he said, "These words are so beautiful, it's hard for me to say this, but try and cut it in half again." And we did that a couple of times. It came out as one paragraph in the Sunday newspaper.
So was this? Did this encourage you to pursue that career further?
Yes. It taught me a certain economy of language.
I did want to mention that you also were interviewed for the CIA.
Was interviewed for the CIA.
But that was another choice that you decided against. What was that experience like?
I graduated from Yale in June of 56. Mm-hmm. Went to Cambridge University in the fall of 1956, and I had not been particularly engaged in foreign affairs as a student at Yale. I'd been reading the works of Bertolt Brecht and Albert Camus and obscure medieval poets, and I had not been following the newspapers. But suddenly, the fall of 1956 is the year of the Hungarian uprising, and it's also the year of the Suez Canal crisis, and a number of young men that I knew in Cambridge had gone to Budapest to show support for the uprising, and two of them had actually been killed. And so suddenly I was having to justify and explain American foreign policy to some very angry English undergraduates, and I didn't know anything. So I began to read newspapers and books, and when I came back from Cambridge, having given up the idea of being a historian, I stopped on the way to San Francisco in the newspaper business. I stopped in Washington and had an interview with the agency, because Yale was a recruiting outpost for the agency during the late 40s and the 50s, and a couple of my English professors had sort of mumbled over drinks at Maury's that if I was ever at a loose end in Washington to call this number. So I called the number, and the CIA in those days it did not yet have its offices in Langley, Virginia. It was in temporary headquarters, which were Quonset huts down near the Lincoln Memorial. And the examinations went on for about a week. There were physical examinations, mental examinations, and psychological examinations. And I got through those, and finally I got to the interview. And the interview was with what the agency called some of the younger guys. And I was 22, I guess, 1957. And these guys must have been in their late 20s, early 30s. There were about three of them, four of them. All Yale, and all George Bush kind of Yale. I mean, from those that defense club, DKE. I mean, it was that preppy tone, and they were very pleased with themselves. It was like being interviewed for the best fraternity in the world. I was going to get to play the big varsity game of the Cold War, right? And I had studied for this exam. I hadn't quite written things on the cuff of my shirt. I was prepared to tell you how many roads there were through the Ardennes forest, and where was the Fulda Gap, and the Romanov dynasty, and the tragedy of the Habsburgs, and Lenin's early life. You know, I was up for that kind of question. And the first question was, you are standing on the 13th tee at the National Golf Club Links in Southampton. What club do you hit? That question tells you, A, are you the right sort that would have mm-hmm. known where the National Golf mm-hmm. Links was, and B, how good a golfer you were, mm-hmm. because it was a short hole. And depending on whether you hit a 4-iron or a 7-iron would mm-hmm. place you in the hierarchy of golfers. I answered that question. I knew that question. Second question was... Second question was, it is late August, 6 o'clock in the evening, and you are on your final tack into the Hay Harbor Yacht Club on Fisher's Island. Mm-hmm. What tack are you on? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I knew that one. Third question was, does Minxy Haynes wear a slip? Minxy was the great kind of nymphomaniac figure of the Ivy League circuit in the 50s, and everything. She was a wild thing, as the expression had it. And I said, gentlemen, I said, I can't answer that question. I have, you know, my information is secondhand rumors. Mm-hmm. I have a rumor of Belgian lace, but it's unconfirmed. And the and I said, beside that, clearly I made a mistake. I apologize for wasting your time. And the I got up and walked out. And the I've never been surprised at the blunders of the CIA since that day, because these people were deeply self-absorbed, and, mm-hmm. and they were not, you know, they were not really going to learn much. So that when they got it wrong about the end of the Cold War, and when they got it wrong about Vietnam, that didn't shock me.
So let's go back to journalism now. You wound up at Harper's. You came to Harper's at the time that Willie Morris was editor?
Yeah, Willie Morris was. I came to Harper's. I'd been at the Saturday Evening Post in the 60s, and the Saturday Evening Post folded, I think, in 1968. And I had a contract to write 8 pieces a year, and I traveled all over. I spent most 6 months of the year traveling. And California, Europe, Washington, Caribbean, wherever. And that was a wonderful job. But the magazine failed. Then I had the same job at Life. Life folded. And then I became a contributing writer to Harper's Magazine about 1970. And I can remember the first piece that I wrote was about the oil bonanza in Alaska, when the Prudhoe Bay North Slope oil came in and all of the money went into the jurisdiction of the government. So I spent the 3 months of the first legislature in Juneau to see how they would dispose of their sudden good fortune. And I wrote that article for Harper's Magazine, and then I was working on a second article about Wall Street when Willie Morris got into an argument with the then publisher of the magazine, a man named Coles. The magazine was then owned by the Minneapolis Star and Tribune Company. And I didn't know Willie very well. I mean, I met him a couple of times, mostly at a bar called the Lanes uptown New York. Second Avenue, and so I was not really privy to the argument. I didn't have any. I'd only been in the office twice to bring a manuscript, and so I didn't see it the way he did. He and his friends, some of the other contributing writers, saw it as an argument, art versus money, and I didn't see it that way. So that when he quit, and so did, or was fired. I mean, it depends who's telling the story. And so did the other 5 or 6 people. And so on a Monday, I was a contributing writer, and on Tuesday, I became the acting managing editor. Mm-hmm. And then it was a fluke, and it is 30 years later. But I stayed as the editor because it gave me a chance to write. And that was dear to me. Mm-hmm. So I learned to be an editor.
So you fell into a position for really a distinguished journal in American history, a magazine rather.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that magazine and you know what it stood for.
Well, Harper's Magazine is what we like to say it's the oldest continuously published magazine in the country. It was established in 1850. The Scientific American was established in the 1830s, but then went out of business for 30 years before it was revived. Harper's has never missed an issue since 1850. There was a company called Harper and Brothers. They were a publisher, book publisher, founded in 1819. By 1850, the biggest publisher in the world, bigger than any publisher in Europe, in England, or in Scotland. And they started the magazine to take up downtime on their new presses and also to use the magazine as a way of promoting their books. They put serial novels by Dickens and Trollope, and also to attract writers. I mean, Harper's Magazine published the first piece published by Mark Twain, which came in as a letter from Hawaii, but the S looked like, the T's in those days could look like an S, so the first piece appears under the name Mark Swain. And the first editor was an extraordinary man. It was a man named Henry Raymond, who had been born in what was the outback country of western New York in 1820. And he came to New York in the 1840s, and he was the executive editor of Horace Greeley's Tribune. Greeley was a man who went around like to make speeches. He was a presence. Young Raymond was the man that actually wrote the paper in the 1840s. The Harper brothers hired him to be the first editor of Harper's Magazine. And in 1851, Raymond founded the New York Times, and he was the first editor of the New York Times at the same time that he was the editor of Harper's Magazine. And then in 1853, he was elected to the legislature in Albany and became speaker of the lower house, still retaining the editorship of the Times and the editorship of the Harper's Magazine, and manuscripts would be sent up the river to him by steamboat. Eventually, he gave up the magazine, kept the paper. Then he gave up the political career to become the speechwriter and champion for John Charles Fremont, the senator from California, the great pathfinder, who was the first Republican candidate for the presidency in 1856. And so Raymond writes the founding documents of what we now know as the Republican Party for a convention in Pittsburgh in 1850s. But he's still the editor of the Times. And then he becomes Fremont loses, and Raymond becomes friends with Lincoln, writes a campaign biography, very good book about Lincoln prior to the election of 1860. And died at an early age, in age of 50, in 1870. But he was a very fine writer, as well as an energetic editor.
Does being an editor make you a better writer? Is there a nice synergy between those two?
Yes, I think it might. I mean, it helps you see your own errors. I mean, it helps you appreciate the, like the story in Oakland, cutting it by 4,000 words. I mean, it helps you to trim out excess language. my writing, I think, is getting better because it's getting simpler. I'm getting more careful about using adjectives. But it does.
And as editor, you have written a column in your new book, Pretense to Empire, which will be on sale outside, is a collection of those essays
yeah.
that you've written during this period. How do you write? I'm curious about that. I know that in the recent issue of Harper's, you have a piece on private armies and their role in history, looking at our present use of the privatization of the military and going back in history. How long did it take you to write that piece?
Well, I write slowly. I write, first of all, longhand, and then I dictate it to my secretary, and then she gives me back the typed copy, and I correct that, and I probably write 6 or 7 drafts. I also keep a journal of what I read, whether it's newspaper or whether I'm reading whatever book I happen to be reading. I keep sort of a daily log. And I've been reading a number of books about the private armies, most wonderfully one by a woman named Frances Stoner Saunders called The Devil's Broker, which is about a mercenary captain with a private army in northern Italy in the 14th century named Sir John Hawkwood. Actually, the early private bandit armies of the late 14th century are the early models of our modern corporation. I mean, they were set up in very similar ways, with very similar objects in view. And so I'd been reading her book and making occasional notes on what she had been saying. And then as the Halliburton story became more prominent in the news, I made the connection. But it's like that. I mean, I whatever, something comes out of the news, and I usually have some odd historical or not so odd historical reference in mind.
And in that essay and in the book, it's very clear that history is very important for you as you think about issues and want to place them in a broader context than the present. But also sarcasm, too, and irony and so on are powerful tools in your hand.
Well, yeah, the sarcasm and irony are helped by a sense of history because you can get a juxtaposition between either a not-so-idealized past or a possibly idealized future. But the irony and the sarcasm work because it's a dissonance. But you have to have at least two elements going for you before you can have the dissonance. And as I say, I started out wanting to be an historian after Yale, went to Cambridge, and have always learned from history. Cicero makes the, Cicero's point is not to know what happened before one was born is always to be a child. And then there's Twain's wonderful line where he says, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so you can, I find it a way of learning something. It's it gives you a context. And I'm now going to start a new journal. I mean, I left Harper's Magazine in order to start something called Laffan's Quarterly, which is going to, God willing, first issue would come out sometime next spring or early summer, where I will take an idea that's in the news, perpetual states of war, or predicament of women, or dream of empire, or failure of economy, and so on, and write a brief introduction. introductory essay and then run out a series of texts, maybe 40, 50 of them, on that theme, taken, you know, out of a historical record. So I'd be editing people like Seneca or Thucydides, but I also do fictions. I'd allow myself to do Shakespeare and Balzac and Cervantes, as well as Gibbon and Macaulay, and try to give the reader a sense of the historical context. We've been there before, and we can learn from the past. I mean, we have nothing else really with which to build the future except the lumber of the past. And I find that a lot of people today lack that context. And if you don't have that context, and if you're lost in the perpetual present of the television, because there's television is a form that there's really no past and no present. There's no cause and effect. It's the eternal now. And that is a very frightening place to live. And it instills in people a sense of credulous anxiety. And if you have a sense of your own history, it gives you a place to stand.
I have a quote from you. Print allows for narrative and continuity, for a beginning, a middle, and an end, for cause and effect, straight lines, the novels of Jane Austen, etc. The electronic media dote on the emotions, on discontinuity, impressions, improvisations, and pattern recognition. You wrote that somewhere.
I did. I was writing about... I'm borrowing those ideas of McLuhan's on the... he makes that, you know, he says this in his book Understanding Media, which was published in 1964. And when I read it in 1964, I didn't understand it because he has a tendency toward an oracular style. But then in 1994, 30 years later, I was asked to write an introduction to a new edition of Understanding Media. And learned a great deal from it, and he is distinguishing between the different forms of sensibility that come about in response to different forms of media. He begins with the premise that we shape our tools, and then our tools shape us. And the electronic revolution is, to his mind, equally as important as the revolution that takes place after the invention of movable type in Gutenberg in the 14th century. So we learn to look at the world through a different lens, and it's true about the, at least I think, what he says about the electronic media seems to me to be so. I mean, it is a circular. It's about emotion. It really, the content isn't as important as the surge of emotion. And it really doesn't matter what the emotion is about. And I think that's one of our problems is how to make a coherent political idea in the new forms of media.
And this, his insights and your comments on those insights seem to me to be a path into understanding our present political situation. Because the people in charge these days in Washington seem to be very attuned to manipulating these differences in print and the media, and in essence, they're better at packaging their lies than anybody else.
Yes, they're very good at it. I mean, they approach politics in the manner of the advertising business, mm-hmm. and the time allowances are very short. I mean, I once did a 6-part television documentary on the history of American foreign policy in the 20th century. And you would think that 6 hours was a lot of time, but it's not. And and I can remember being confronted with a problem of, I had something like 73 words and 43 seconds, or 43 words and 73 seconds, I can't remember which, in which to explain or account for the outbreak of World War II. And not only did I have to fit it to that time and those words, but I also had to connect still photographs of the Munich conference in September 1938 with the bombing of Warsaw in September 1939. And that's the kind of medium that it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've yet... We have this wonderful toy, but I'm not sure that we've yet developed a language that can use it as an art. McLuhan makes that point, too. The movable type comes along in the end of the 15th century, I think. But it's another 100 years before you get to Cervantes and Shakespeare and Montaigne. Mm-hmm. So it takes time before we can learn how to use these forms. And that's one of the confusions that we see happening today. You know, what is the media and newspapers and internet? And it's almost the more we know, the less we know. And how do we know what we know? I mean, these are epistemological problems.
Your book is a collection of essays which you wrote over a period from 2002, say, to the present. And at the time that you were writing these essays, what you were saying wasn't as apparent to a broader audience. And now... Yeah. Everything is hitting the fan. The Bush order is unraveling day by day, and
yeah.
so on. So I think our audience should go and read your book. But what I want to pull out of you is your insights, because there are many about the structural things that are at work. And one of them is what we just talked about, the way the media
yeah.
has
yeah.
changed, and he who controls the media, this new kind of narrative, is the one who can
yeah.
have political power. Another insight that you draw on, you talk about a seminar you go to hear a discussion of Thorsten Veblen's writings.
Right.
And you go back and do some reading, the good historian that you are, and you were taken by his insights. I believe he was writing about land developers and the
right.
need to sell the land and fool the people, and there would be a pot of gold in the Emerald City and so on.
Yeah.
And so this is another theme in America that brings us to the present in a way, basically, the nature of our capitalism and the forms it's taken.
Yeah, I mean, Veblen is a extraordinarily, I think, sharp-eyed and witty observer of the American scene. He is, of course, the man who invents the term conspicuous consumption and the theory of the leisure class and the spending of money in order to prove one's state of grace, really. I mean, not for a utilitarian purpose, mm-hmm. but for a display purpose. And in that essay, what I think I was talking about was Veblen talking about the economy of a small town in the Middle West in the 1890s. But I used his essay to try to show that there really wasn't that much of a difference between the red state and the blue state. I mean, the red state, blue state division that the Republicans make so much of is really an advertiser's demographic. It doesn't accurately reflect the way people think in different parts of the country. In other words, in order to assign somebody an attitude simply because of their address is, you know, that's the way you would try to sell them a watch. Mm-hmm. But it's really not the way you would try to find out what was in their mind, and I was using the essay that way.
As the editor of Harper's for 3 decades,
yeah,
you had a seat to really see the changing currents in the literary scene and in our culture. What was being an editor in the 70s different from being an editor in the 80s and the 90s and, you know, into the present? How did the writing change? How did the selection of pieces that you could run change? What were the different constraints, if any? Did America change in that period, and did you see it from your position at Harper's?
Yes, I mean, when I become managing editor in 1971, and I became the editor in 1975. And during the period of in the 70s, I think that I was still trying to think of the magazine as the marketplace of ideas, right? And I was trying to think of it in terms of debate. I would publish pieces written by individuals who were on the left and individuals who were also on the right. And during that period of the 70s, some of the leading arguments, political arguments, were on the side of the right. I mean, the early writings of people like William Kristol and Norman Podhoretz, who subsequently congealed into hard shell neoconservatives, but in the 70s they were a lot of people of that kind of persuasion were making good points about some of the weaknesses in the American liberal imperium. Late 30s, 40s, 50s, you could say that the American, almost the entire American intellectual landscape was liberal, whether you're talking about the Democratic control of the Congress or the attitude in place in the school system and the foundations and most of the publications and the conservative side of the argument, or what has become the conservative side of the argument, was really irritable twitching, I think. Mm-hmm. That's not my phrase. I think that's Galbraith's, but somebody was making that point. But in the 70s, it was possible you could come into arguments and have a real engagement with people on different sides of the question. And people could go so far as to say that they were wrong, or that they could learn something, and there was a conversation after the Reagan election in the 80s, and it increasingly became what had been a more fluid exchange of ideas, hardened, I think, into more polemical positions. You're either with us or against us. And if you're with us, you're going to be writing for either the Nation on the one hand or National Review on the other. And there was a tendency for people to stop talking to each other and to be using words rather, instead of as means of expression, as blunt instruments with which to, you know, belabor their enemies. And the and then there's also the loss of vocabulary, which is something else that McLuhan points out. 1941, the average vocabulary of the of a high school student was, as high school senior, was something like 9,000 or 10,000 words, and then 4 or 5 years ago, when I last saw the statistic, it was down to 5,000 words. So that's a result of television, of the broadcast discourse. You again, when you find that you're writing for television, you can't. It's hard to use long words. You can't really back into sentences with participial clauses. It has to start, you know, subject, verb, object. You know, it's a kind of Dick and Jane language that and that has an effect. You begin to lose the devices of irony, and we now have, I think that it's a very big number that the Department of Health Education places on the illiteracy of the American public. I don't know the number, but it's something like 20 or 30 million, or maybe even 40.
I have the quote from Orwell's Politics in the English Language, but one ought to recognize that the present political chaos is connected with the decay of language, and that one can probably bring about some improvement by starting at the verbal end. Do you think we're not teaching our students to write anymore, and that is part of the solution to this problem of restoring the democratic ethos? Because you, I sense that you believe strongly that we can't have citizens who are active and engaged and thinking unless they can write and talk and have the skills that we used to learn.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, yes, I certainly think that.
Yeah.
And it's not only the skill and the habit of reading and of writing, but it's also the time to allow that kind of a conversation to take place. The kind of conversation that you and I are now having is almost impossible. I can't imagine where on television this could happen, because to stop and pause and seem to think is a crime. From a television camera's point of view.
Yeah.
And so it isn't only that people don't learn to write because they don't acquire the habit of reading. And it takes time to teach people how to write. You have to learn grammar and syntax, and you know, begin. But you must read, because there's no other way to learn it.
So I guess the question is: are we at a tipping point so that the impeachment? You wrote an essay on some work that Representative Conyers was doing in the House. In essence, I believe he was saying, "Well, I'm doing this, even though it may not have an effect now, but I will have taken, you know, a stance." So the question is, as all of this is now coming out to a broader audience, the failure in Iraq, the failure in response to Katrina, and so on, are we at a tipping point so that impeachment could conceivably become a political reality, that the Democrats come in both houses of Congress and begin investigations? Do you think we could realistically hope for an impeachment of George Bush?
No, but I think I do again think, like Conyers, the piece in the book that you're referring to is called A Case for Impeachment, and it follows from bill introduced into Congress by John Conyers of Michigan last December, suggesting that there be first censure and then investigation as to whether there were grounds for impeachment. Now, I think that we owe it to ourselves to impeach Bush. Whether the Congress will do that or not is, I would expect not. And I think that would be, to me, that is a failure on the part of the Congress, because what we're talking about, at least what I'm trying to talk about, is, and what Conyers was trying to talk about, is not the failure of a particular policy vis-a-vis Iraq or tax cuts for the wealthy or the Homeland Security and Katrina and minimum wage and so on. It's the Bush administration's attack on the constitutional order on which this country is based. I mean, it is the abuse of power. And it is a usurping of power on the part of the executive, and there are many proofs of that. I mean, the denial of habeas corpus to, this was as recently as last week, to persons suspected or detained on a suspicion of terrorism, the taking of the interpretation of the president's action out of the jurisdiction of the courts, the granting to the president the authority to declare, to decide who and who is not an enemy combatant, whether a foreign national or an American citizen, the flat statement on the part of Bush with regard to the warrantless tapping of telephones and the interception of email messages, and he says, in fact, I will do as I please. Mm-hmm. And the muzzling of the Congress, the Republican majority acting in sort of as a stormtrooper for the executive, for the administration, the refusal on the part of the government to give to the Congress information that it constitutionally deserves to have. The conduct of government behind closed doors, the increased seizure of power to interfere with the lives of the citizens, and so on. There's a whole long list. Mm-hmm. And the refusal to recognize international treaties. The impeachment is process. It's not to punish Bush. Bush, any competent criminal court in the country could mm-hmm. send Bush mm-hmm. to jail mm-hmm. for, you know, fraud. It's not the responsibility of the Congress to censure Bush morally. Mm-hmm. The Yale Divinity School can do that. And the
take back his degree.
Or Jerry Falwell can do that. But it is the responsibility of the Congress to maintain the balance of power on which the country is based, and not to completely abdicate it's the power of the legislature. And it is for this reason that, and so you have, and the founders recognized this. They recognized that when the abuse of power could become so excessive on the part of the executive, that it's harmful to the mechanics of decent government. And so to remove Bush is like removing a tumor. It's a malign growth on the body politic, and that is the way the impeachment should be understood. And I'm afraid the Congress won't understand it that way. But I do think if we, as a country or as a political body, continue to believe in democracy in the way that we say that we believe in it, we would impeach him. But again, I think that what has been happening over the last 20-odd years is a loss of faith in the possibility of the democratic idea. And that's not only happening in the United States, that's happening in Europe. It's happening in England. Many of the same kinds of things that the Bush administration is doing in the U.S., the Blair government is doing in England. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, you get more belief in the idea of democracy in the East than you do in the West. Mm-hmm. And that strikes me as a profound irony. Yeah, so I do think, to go back to your question, yes, it is a tipping point.
So we want to leave our audience, especially the young people, with some element of hope here.
Yeah.
And I guess what I want to ask you is, looking at our history, you know, our traditions, when they haven't been corrupted, what kind of political movement do you see emerging that might turn these things around? It's not clear to me at all that it will be in the Democratic Party. It's conceivable it could be in something like the environmental movement, which is posing a threat that is a real threat to, you know, the world as we know it, based on what we as humanity are doing to the environment. What are the possibilities here that you know, you have thought about or you're hoping for or what?
Well, I think there are a lot of possibilities. I was had coffee this afternoon with a friend of mine named Arthur Blaustein, who's a teacher here at Berkeley, and has organized a number of volunteer organizations. AmeriCorps, I believe, is one of them, and I think you have the largest contingent of those kinds of volunteers anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Several hundred undergraduates who are approaching the notion of the common good as participants. And whether it takes the form of teaching in the poorer school districts or working on environmental issues, that is the democratic idea. It's still alive and well, I mean, in the country as a whole. I mean, you have a ballot, I think, in Berkeley and in San Francisco to impeach Bush, but as a local initiative. And the trouble is that the notion, the idea of democracy, if you go back to Montesquieu and the spirit of the law, he distinguishes between the animating principle between democracy, monarchy, aristocracy, despotism. He runs through a number of forms of government. And the one that's implicit in democracy in his mind is virtue. It's a willingness to take care of, look out for one another. And this is, of course, the way it makes a connection to the New Testament. The Bush administration is a great, the Old Testament is their is their text, you know, the miserable, bloody-minded God, right? Ralph Nader made the point very forcefully in the election of 2000 when he said, if a million people in this country would give, over the course of a year, $100 and 100 hours to, I believe, what he called civil or civic service, we could make great changes in the country. And we don't see enough of that in our media. And we don't see enough programs like this one or like the other ones that you do with people who think out loud. And the if I could raise enough money, I'd try to have a television channel like C-SPAN that would just do events like this, because or put the camera in a laboratory, or put it in a dance troupe in New Mexico, or in a theater in Minnesota, or there are a lot of very creative and engaged people in the United States, but the major news media blocks them out. I mean, so what you get instead is Paris Hilton. Mm-hmm. And somehow we got to do more of the kind of thing that you do, and more of the kind of thing that the kids here at Berkeley are doing. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's a lot of hope in that, because the William Sloan Coffin, who was the chaplain at Yale University in the 60s, if you remember, he was very active in both the civil rights movement and in the anti-war movement. And his notion of democracy was that it was the great escape from the prison of the self. In other words, the public interest is more interesting than I am. I mean, it gives you a chance to take part in a bigger, more interesting self. Mm-hmm. And that's that was his way of explaining the idea.
So in a way, in this conversation, we've gone back to where we began, because it was sense of the public sphere that you learned as a young person, I think I remember you saying, and that really affected the choices that you made, both in your career and the way you see the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I was very lucky in my childhood in San Francisco to see the what Churchill, to see the formation of the UN, mm-hmm. which is based on these kinds of ideas. It's an imperfect organization, but Churchill said of the UN, it is not about arranging the ascent to heaven. It is about preventing the descent to hell.
And on that note, we have a time frame that is just about ending, and I want to recommend your book to everybody, and I want to leave everybody with a quote from that book, which is, in order to provoke political change, you need language that induces a change of heart. And thank you very much for doing
that. Thank you.